Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for being here. It's great to see you. How's your summer been? You been out? Going fishing? You got a suntan yet? You been on a hike? You done anything nice with your kids? Do you have kids? Do you have a dog? I hope, in some way, shape, or form, you've been finding some peace and some path to just isness and beingness in the moment this summer. And there's a bajillion ways to do that because we have a bajillion new moments and new opportunities to have a happening consistently and constantly coming towards us, always. Like right now, it's a new moment. There's another moment right here. There's so much practice and there's so much time to just look at what's happening and appreciate the moment and what's going on. And going back to school and school times, summer break was always just this opportunity to relax, really. The kids, even though they don't have the exact same grasp of responsibility that an adult does, they still have their tasks and their things that they have to do. And like I always tell Odin, his job is school. And so it'd be great as adults for us to have summer breaks, I think. But it was just this extended time period to sleep in, and this extended time period to just wake up and be excited for all that time, this free time that just seems to come out of nowhere, that just seems to be created sometimes. And adults do have opportunities like this. It's just sometimes they wear coats of perspective or old reactions to perspectives that color us with rose-colored glasses towards how we decide a situation's going to play out. I had a lot of time given to me last Friday, but it was difficult to swallow. It was bitter medicine because my son had, unfortunately, had some troubles and was not able to stay at his place of care. And so I had to leave work rather early and go get him. It's not an old story. It's not a new story. It's just there. I know I'm not the only one who has to go and pick up these pieces sometimes. And I have old reactions built around this setting that causes me to blow up and to go into all these emotional, torturous tirades that doesn't help anybody, including my son, and it only burns me. And so I went to go pick him up around 9 a.m. You know, I'd worked for about an hour. A lot of extra stuff happening. And I controlled myself well and I didn't freak out. And we got home and I took a shower and I got clean and I just sat and I sat by myself and I relaxed and I read. And I chose to take that moment and turn it into a freedom. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what was going on and how I wanted to change it and how I wanted to alchemize it in some sort of transmutation. This weekend, I was talking to a friend and he was telling me stories about how his mother would sometimes just call him in from school and just spend the whole day with him and go do movies and play and just spend the time together, you know? And it made me think about the hundreds and hundreds of bad days that I had prescribed myself because I had decided I wasn't where I was supposed to be. And I made it halfway there this Friday. It was still uncomfortable. You know, I was still stressed and still angry. I was just quietly rationalizing and digesting my feelings so that I could figure out how to talk to my son about it, you know? But the other end of that extreme is simply just calling in for shits and giggles. Like, that's Superman, Superwoman status. And I told him that immediately, how admirable I thought his mother was for doing that. And I had memories of my own dad doing the same stuff with me. And I told him these were special, special days, because those days that my dad spent to choose to just spend with me, I felt like the most special person on the entire world. I felt like the most loved kid on the entire world. And I thought it was just so admirable to have parents like that, who can put down this idea of responsibility just for a second to love their children. I want to be able to do that more. And whenever these situations happen, I don't need to treat him per se. It's not like we got to go get ice cream and sundaes because he got in trouble. But those time periods that I see in the future that will happen again, I want to transmute them into healing moments, because that's time bought, and that's time I don't have usually. I saw a quote online recently where it said, no time is wasted. It's impossible to waste your time. You know, at least you're doing it. No moment's wasted. You're alive. And I really took that to heart. And in reading my book of Emmanuel, which I know I've talked about for the last couple of weeks, if you want to go listen, usually I have my quotations and book stuff towards the end of the episodes. So I know not everybody wants to listen to a quotational bauble from old dead dudes or women. But there's a couple excerpts of Emmanuel over the past two episodes. One of the things he says is that, isn't it enough just to allow your feeling of fear or anger to be? It doesn't necessarily have to be that you have to shame yourself or have any other feelings about the feeling. It doesn't have to be a domino effect of resistant reactions that we've built for ourselves, even if they might be defensive, you know? Isn't it enough just to allow the feeling to be, wow, look how angry I am. All right, there's a new moment. Or I could choose to beat myself up for the next 24 hours because of how I decided something happened. A situation arises spontaneously. There's a certain chaotic rhythm to how things come into being. And using our intuition, which may be just tapping into the field of our connection to the environment, and of course we know what's happening inside our greater field, but isn't it enough just to let it happen? And isn't there a certain gratitude that comes with being able to feel anything? Perhaps there's a depression or a neurosis or maybe even some sort of injury where someone may not be able to have the capacity to have these feelings that you or I can, even if they're incredibly uncomfortable, even if they're incredibly scary, tense, stressful. It's still a feeling. Are we guaranteed feelings once we're dead? You know? This life is like a bubble, ephemeral. It's only going to exist as long as we're supposed to be here. And during this schooling hour of existence, shouldn't we be feeling our feelings instead of shaming ourselves about them? And there's something to learn even from a negative feeling or something that we label as a negative feeling. I was sitting with a friend last night, and he struggles with psychedelia, which is this symptom I've been seeing of modern society with its open access and very little education on how to form a relationship with these chemical compounds, which And reality is simply just forming a relationship with a segment of yourself, which sometimes I've chosen to label as the subconscious, and maybe sometimes as God, perhaps. But I don't think many of us, and even myself included, have even much of any sort of skill when it comes to dallying in the subconscious. And it doesn't always happen to be the expectations or things we've heard about, which is why I feel a lot of people have been struggling with this idea, this breakthrough, which I would argue we're already there. The subconscious is here right now. I may be speaking from my waking conscious, but beneath everything and bubbling up in the abyss and giving me these thoughts and these feelings and this passion to express it to you is the rest of who I am. And I can't quite see it, but it exists right here, right now. It's not hiding. It's not something to be achieved. It's just not within the same observational window as the rest of waking consciousness. And so I misplayed my place, if we're going to speak of a shamanic path or an archetype, rather, because I am by no way indebted with any sort of seriousness to call myself a shaman. I might be a closeted mystic, but I want to help people, and people seem drawn to me. And we've been working on getting him to a place, and he had a good time just a couple weeks back, but his only gripe was that he wanted more. So we got into an argument over what more was and how the value can be found even in things that don't meet our expectations, and sometimes that's the trick. But this evening was not pleasant, unfortunately, and I decided to smoke with him. So we both took our dose at the exact same time, and this taught me how horrible of an idea it is as somebody sitting with somebody. If you're trying to hold somebody and you're trying to help, I'm not quite sure you need to be completely stoned during that moment. I learned this for myself, and I don't plan to be. And 99.9% of the time when I have been gifting or showing people the DMT universe, I typically am not stoned with them. It's been very, very infrequently that I've ever smoked with somebody. It's not a social drug for me. But I felt very inclined to this evening, and so I did. And we waited for a significant time period on my couch, just sitting there, and I heard his deep breathing, and I felt the tension writhing around like the electrical bolts jumping from cumulonimbus clouds as he tried to calm himself. And I waited, and I tried to stay patient, and I did it. Once he held himself still, he used his device, he smoked, and then I smoked. And I was gifted with ecstasy. And I think it's because of my patience and my will. And in some way, I think I wanted to model to him what I felt the substance was. And I was given a beautiful kaleidoscope of internal visualizations that are indescribable, yet so captivating and mysterious. Wisps of color and banners of no color, all in between the between spaces. And I began to feel a cosmic giggle in my stomach. And I just laughed, and I cried, and I yawned. And it was mystical. And I didn't hear much from my friend, so I expected that he was underwhelmed. To back up a little bit, earlier the day, I'd allowed my friend to do some laundry, so at this point in time, his clothes were drying in the dryer with the stereotypical noises that you expect from machinery. Redundant noises are tedious and not best for the circumstance. My friend is sensitive, and usually I try to allocate most external stimuli to be not as present. No TVs, no noise, no child running amok. But I hadn't been thinking about him, and I was only waiting on my own patience with my own experience, which was selfish in hindsight. And so, as I began to stifle my giggle, I looked over, and he began to describe how awful the dryer was, in which circumstance I had no knowledge of the dryer anymore. Within the kaleidoscopal circus behind the retina of my vision, I could no longer even sense a thing like a dryer, or describe it, or know what it was. Yet, so fixated was he on the optimal experience that that's all he could see or hear was this nagging thing. And if I was more in a sober state of mind, I would have been able to talk him through this. And as over like a period of 2 or 3 minutes, I started to get my frame back, and I was able to start to express things well. But he was really distraught and really unhappy and moved by the situation. I gave him advice on things we could do to better situational settings, and I think he agreed. And I also wanted to express to him how, even though my experience was polarly opposite, it was in no way a reflection of his experience in any way, shape, or form. And this is a heavy thing that I think needs to be spoken about when using psychedelia socially together. We are empathetic creatures, and it's very easy for one to pick up on another's feelings or opinions. And if we internally, idealistically oppose those things, then this can be distressing, and it can really be a turnoff for the moment. So, within a philosophy of just being an allowance, you know, another person's experience has to be allowed, and we always have to remind ourselves that it has nothing to do, and it's not a judgment, and it's not a criticism or any sort of comment or advice on what's happening to the other or ourselves. If we happen to be taking something personally that somebody else is doing, it's not a reflection of who we are. This is a massive lesson that creeps out of psychedelia into the real world. And even in waking consciousness, we project and subconsciously do these things to people all the time, where we start to take personally somebody else's situation. Allow it. Allow somebody to be, even if they're shitty, you know? And somebody's crisis, somebody's pain, allow it to be. I have often in the past felt like it was somebody bursting my bubble, and so I would get mad at somebody else's bad day, which in hindsight is just almost evil in the way I see it. Yet even in psychedelia, somebody can have a bad experience and take it personally that somebody else is having a good experience. Like, somebody else's ecstasy can be very insulting. But it shouldn't be. But even the person in ecstasy should be mindful not to gloat around and gloat and try to snub somebody's nose in their own shit, if that metaphor holds. But the last piece of advice that really stuck with me that I was still thinking about this morning that I tried to give him was that these distressful, tense, hard moments that come up like waves, they're still important. It's not all bad. Life isn't all bad. Psychedelia isn't all bad. It's a roll of a dice. It's a crapshoot sometimes within chaos. But it's not all bad. I don't think any of it's bad. I would even say none of it's good either. It just is. But it's all important. And when we are exposed to something, especially with a potent thing like this, if it gives us something hard to deal with, you know, like I told him, I was like, maybe even outside of the substance, when you're working on something, you need a very quiet space, and that's going to have a huge impact on you. And maybe this is what your subconscious is telling you, is how important it is for that. And I even apologized for not having the setting there for him and not being more mindful about it. But there's even a message in there, a shitty time, you know? But sometimes it's easier said than done. When we're in a moment, we can only see our fear. It's like blinders, being in a tunnel. When you're angry at something, you can only see what you're angry at. And within patience, maybe acknowledgement, we can see outside the blinders. We can wait it out. And it's always wiser to react when we're in a more sober mindset, even within waking consciousness, because we can get high on our own supply of hormones. And we can rile ourselves up into our own little tornadoes without anything. So it all applies to all segments, this learning game, the schoolhouse. Speaking of school, I was having a little bit of difficulty at my work, and it made me think back to working on a team in school. I'm sure we all remember team projects. Some of them are more extensive than others. I always hated the ones that you had to go over to another person's house, because I was always very socially awkward and uncomfortable. I was always like some kid that wasn't my friend, you know? And like, I hated going over to other people's house to work on projects, but sometimes it was just in class. But we all know that one person, that one participant that was not participating. How did that feel? You remember that feeling of somebody not pulling their weight? A couple of months back, the two fingers on my left hand, like my pinky finger and the one right next to it, went completely numb, and it was hard for me to use my hand. Like, it was difficult for me to do tasks because of my numb hand. And so a team is like a hand. Whether it's a work team, or a friendship team, or a family team, or a loose association like a mob that sometimes forms when people just start to work together on any sort of thing. It operates within what I would say is a much more natural setting of being this oneness, this overmind, this groupthink, really, right? So when our fingers stop working, it can be super aggravating, irritating. Like, but if we can fix the finger, I would still say it's probably better than just chopping it off and writing it off and saying, I can work with three fingers now. Fuck it. It was numb, now I don't have any, right? How idiotic is that? But within a team still, when somebody's not pulling, it's aggravating, it's irritating. We start to feel this sense of fairness. My opinion on fairness is esoteric, and I'm not quite sure if it exists beyond a judgment call within our own minds yet again. But within a feeling of being unfaired upon when somebody does something that's so unfair, there's this need for vindication and revenge. And I fell into this trap last week working with a team member who was having a bad day. And instead of allowing them to be and allowing them to figure their shit out, I became part of their bad day. Because I decided that one of my fingers wasn't working. And that made everything more difficult. When we find a situation like this, and outside of school, our teams, the ones that we really depend upon, can have a lot more bigger impact on our security and our safety. But before I leave you this week, and we'll try to figure out some more answers next week, how do we promote the best work ethic even when part of our organism is sick? How can we alleviate without frustration and help the members of our teams that have fallen under? Is it their fault? Is it a personal situation that is completely reflected on us? Is that logical? I'm not so sure. So that's what I want you to think about this week, is how we can uplift all parts of the small and the large teams in society and in our homes and our workplaces. We'll talk a lot more about that next week. All right. I think I've gone on for quite enough. I appreciate you so much being here. This is still one of my favorite things to do, is to just sit here and speak with you. I hope you know that this is coming from a place of real earnestness. I want to help. I want to be there for you, and I want to give you the stability where you could be there for others. I want to inspire your creativity, your interest in life. I want you to avidly go pursue whatever the fuck you're interested in, even if it has nothing to do with who I am. I just want you to care. And I want love to flourish in our world. And I think that is an infectious act. And so starting here, even though this is a very vague and abstract portal to communicate with you, just know that I love you, that I have love for your circumstance. And I'm so grateful that you woke up and you breathed this morning. And I hope you can go love somebody else too, including yourself, because you're worth it. You're an amazing creature. So, I'm going to go grab a book, and then we'll see how Odin's doing today. I'm sure he's got some words of wisdom for you that he wants to share. So I'm reading from Friedrich Nietzsche's The Will to Power, translated by Anthony M. Ludovici. This was initially published in 1914. Nietzsche lived in the 1800s. He was from Germany. He was not a nihilist, but was consumed with ideas of nihilism, where nihilism is the antithesis of meaning. A true nihilist believes there's no meaning and no purpose to anything. And there's aggressive, active nihilism, which goes out and decides to destroy or to circumvent other people's established belief systems through proselytizing or persuasion. And also passive nihilism, which is much more not really trying to affect anybody else, but within one's own meaning system and with one's own life. And Nietzsche was very critical of Buddhism because he thought Buddhism was a passive nihilism. But I disagree and have my own opinions on that matter. Either way, I found this book quite captivating, and it has a lot of things that have to do, like I said, with meaning. And I don't agree with everything he says, but he's very intelligent, and he had a critical eye for these things, and I like how he describes some of these things. This is from part of the book which is explicitly criticizing religion, which yet again, I still think that religion has its place in society and for people as a whole. But Nietzsche had very firm convictions against it. Either way, hopefully this will interest your ear holes. It'll give you something to ruminate upon. Here goes. In this way, the concepts good and evil are created and seem quite divorced from the natural concepts useful, harmful, life-promoting, life-retarding. Indeed, inasmuch as another life is imagined, the former concepts may even be antagonistic to nature's concepts of good and evil. In this way, the proverbial concept conscience is created, an inner voice which, through it, makes itself heard in regard to every action, does not measure the worth of that action according to its results, but according to its conformity or nonconformity to the law. The holy lie, therefore, invented. 1. A God who punishes and has rewards, who recognizes and carefully observes the law book of the priests, and who is particular about sending them into the world as his mouthpiece and plenipotentiaries. 2. An afterlife, in which alone the great penal machine is supposed to be active. To this end, the immortality of the soul was invented. 3. A conscience in man, understood as the knowledge that good and evil are permanent values, that God himself speaks through it whenever its counsels are in conformity with priestly precepts. 4. Morality as the denial of all natural processes, as the subjection of all phenomena to moral order, as the interpretation of all phenomena, as the effects of a moral order of things, that is to say, the concept of punishment and reward, as the only power and the only creator of all transformations. 5. Truths given, revealed, and identical with the teachings of the priests, as the condition to all salvation and happiness in this and the next world. In short, what is the price paid for the improvement supposed to be due to morality? The unhinging of reason, the reduction of all motives to fear and hope, dependence upon the tutelage of priests, and upon a formulary exactitude which is supposed to express a divine will, the implantation of a conscience which establishes a false science in the place of experience and experiment, as though all one had to do or had not to do was predetermined, a kind of contraction of the seeking and striving spirit. In short, the worst mutilation of man that can be imagined, and it is pretended that the good man is the result. So, here's my two cents. Very critical message, but perhaps we have to always, and this is what I think the Buddha would say, we always have to establish a system from our own self-worth and our own self-idea. Whether or not that self is a real functional thing, that's the viewpoint that we see from and do things from. I think he saw a lot of people going out to the priesthood and adopting their meaning system and adopting in a contractual agreement with this idea that somebody else had made. So perhaps we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and we still appreciate an idea of a personal God, but we don't just take the medicine because somebody said we had to, even if that person saying we had to is ourselves. All right. Well, let's go for it.
Hello, this is Ask O. So, how was your day today? I bet you said it was good, and...
How was your day?
Good, you know, good. I always have a good day and
Are
stuff.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you enjoying the weather?
Yeah, it's very sunny.
It is very sunny.
I have a friend called Bella, and I'm about to play with her outside.
What is the most important part about friends?
Well, a girlfriend.
Oh.
If you have a friend, if a girl, you could get married.
Oh, jeez. That's
then
serious.
If you have a boyfriend. And if you are a boy and you have a friend that also is a boy, you can just play and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's not quite exactly what I was asking, but that's interesting. It's very enlightening.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That's loud. I appreciate your time.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.